told John I went to school. Teacher asked the class, hey, what did y'all do this weekend? Little Johnny said, well, me and my dad went fishing this weekend. She said, oh, yeah, did you catch anything? He said, yeah, we went out this weekend. She said, how many catch? He said, we caught 100 fish. Now, little Johnny was prone to exaggeration. And she said, little Johnny, you caught 100 fish. He said, yes, ma'am, caught 100 fish. She said, well, how big were they? He said, every one of them weighed 100 pounds each. She said, little Johnny, you caught 100 fish, and every one of them weighed 100 pounds. Are you telling me the truth? He said, yes, ma'am. Caught 100 fish, that weighed 100. She said, that would be 10,000 pounds of fish. She said, you don't have a boat that would be big enough to... He said, I don't know how much they weigh, but I know every single fish weighed 100 pounds, and we caught 100 of them. She said, Johnny, you are making that up. She said, what if I just made up stories like that to tell y'all? Like, I'm on my way to school, and I'm driving my car, and this huge 10-foot-tall grizzly bear comes out of the woods and begins to shake my car, and from the other side, a little 2-pound chihuahua runs up, grabs it by the nose, flips it over, beats it up, and chases it off. Would you believe that? Well, John said, yes, ma'am. That's my dog. Well, we'll try to keep the stories legitimate here as we discuss the next aspect of creation and evolution. Now, what we're told is that creation is not scientific because it's not repeatable and you can't use your five senses to validate the idea of God or creation, and that evolution is scientific. And then when you say, well, hold on just a second, I don't think that matches up, they said, well, yes, and here's the evidence for evolution. And so we're going to go through the textbooks this morning, and we're going to look at some of the evidence that is used to teach evolution. And this particular sticker was placed in the Cobb County, Georgia biology textbooks. Here's what the sticker says. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. I think very well worded. This caught all kinds of national and probably international attention to such a degree that it was made into a very big court case. And it was taken to the district court there in the area, and the people were suing to get this sticker out. And they were suing because they said this is a violation of the separation of church and state. And they won. They said that this particular sticker that said evolution is a theory, not a fact, that should be looked at with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered, well, it's unconstitutional because it violated the separation, wall of separation clause, and it was just too religious. Okay, well, let's look at the sticker again. This sticker, this book contains information on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, about living things. It should be looked at with an open mind, studied carefully, critically considered. Do you see anything about Jesus in the sticker? No. Anything about God? Anything about the Bible? Anything about a creator? Anything about supernatural, anything of any sort? No, you don't. Well, why was this viewed as too religious? They said, well, of course, the only alternative to evolution is creation. And really what you're trying to do is sneak creation in the back door, and you're trying to force these kids to question and doubt evolution, and that means it's religiously motivated. Now, hold on just a second. Now, it is true, sadly, that some religious people don't want their young people to question or to critically think through what they teach them. They want them to just intake everything that they tell them. Don't question it. That's just how we've always done it. This is just how you need to be. But that's not what New Testament Christianity has ever prescribed for its followers. In fact, if you were to look to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, the text that Paul wrote said, test all things and hold on to what is good. Now, if God is the creator of everything and God wrote the Bible, then there should be nothing in science, real science, that would contradict anything in the text, because God is the originator of both of those. And real New Testament Christianity says, let's look at everything. Let's test it all, and we'll hold fast to what's true, we'll get rid of what's not, and that is how Christianity works. In fact, Jesus, when he was here, he said, you don't have to believe me just because I say it. You know, believe me because of the miracles, believe me because of the predicted prophecy that I'm fulfilling, believe me because I'm going to predict my own death and come back to life exactly as I say. And then in Acts chapter 1, it says he presented himself alive by many infallible proofs. And Peter said we didn't follow cunningly devised fables, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. Evidence-based. It's always been evidence-based. And so this idea that somehow creation is not evidence-based, but evolution is. Well, if that were the case, then would anybody discourage a person from looking at evolution with an open mind? If it were based on the evidence. From looking at it critically and carefully considering it. And here's what I tell all my kids. And everybody that I talk to, you should look at everything with an open mind and study it carefully and critically consider it. Now, when you do, I believe you arrive on the other side of that research and that discovery as a stronger Christian with a more powerful faith in a creator God because the evidence points in that direction. But what happens when you do that to the evolutionary teaching? Well, what happens, and what the people who write these textbooks know, is that if you start questioning this stuff that has been used to teach evolution, you're going to find some real serious problems. Because we've been told that evolution is an evidence-based system, but when you start looking at the evidence that it's based on, well, I'll give you some examples of this. When you're told in any number of biology textbooks, and virtually every single one of them that is state-sponsored, is that some 4.8 billion years ago, there was a tiny soup of some sort that had non-living chemicals in it. And something like lightning struck that chemical soup and caused the first single cell to form. And that single cell, over millions of years, evolved into multicell bacteria, and that multicell bacteria evolved into, and it added genetic information all along the way. But the problem with that is, there's a fundamental law in biology that makes that idea impossible. And that's the law of biogenesis. Now here's what the law of biogenesis says. It's very simple. The law of biogenesis says that every living creature in the natural world arises from a previous living creature of its own kind. Now here's what that means. Now, years ago I had a dog, and this dog was named Max. And this was when I was probably 3 or 4 years old, and we were in East Tennessee. And Max was coming with us as we moved, but Max was in the family way. And so we stopped at a hotel, and I'm sure we didn't tell the people in this particular, I think it was a motel, one where all the doors open out, you know, and we didn't know where else to put the dog, I guess, or my dad put him in the bathtub, put him in the bathtub. So my dad puts Max, our dog, in the bathtub. We wake up the next morning, and lo and behold, we look in the bathtub, and Max has had babies. 8 of the most beautiful hippopotamuses you have ever seen. And we sold those to zoos, and that's how I paid for my education to feed Hardeman. And you think, okay, no, Max doesn't give birth to a hippopotamus. Okay, that's right. You're right. Of course, she didn't have 8 hippopotamuses. She had 8 of the most beautiful half dogs, half hippopotamuses. We called them dippopotamuses. They were amazing. They were half. Okay, not half and half. All right. 8 of the most beautiful 98% dog, 2% lizard, called them lizards. They had a little scale right on their head. Well, what's the problem with that? Dogs always give birth to puppies. Cats always give birth to kittens. Horses always give birth to foals. Cows always give birth to calves. You do understand that in the entirety of the human scientific endeavor, forever, number one, life never originates in the natural world from non-living chemicals. And number two, it always reproduces after its own kind. Always. Now, here's the aspect of evolution that is so remarkable. It violates the law of biogenesis on both accounts. It says, number one, life has to pop into existence from non-living chemicals. And then number two, it has to change from one kind into another. But not once, but twice and 3 times and multiplied millions of times. Well, if you were just to say, what does the science show us? They would say, well, if you mutate DNA enough, you can get it to change. Well, okay, let's try that. We've got the fruit fly that we have been zapping with mutation for the last 120 years. In the early 1900s, we said, hey, if evolution is true, we should be able to take this fruit fly, which brings us a new generation of fruit fly every 14 days. Well, if you could radiate a generational fruit fly and then radiate that next one and then radiate that next one, you could get the equivalent of millions of years of time, evolutionary time, in just a few years because you would have each generation. So let's see what we can do. So that's what they've done. They've taken the fruit fly and they've zapped it, and they have gotten where they can radiate a fruit fly and make it grow a wing out of its head, or a leg out of its head, or multiple eyes. Multiple wings, fruit flies without wings, fruit flies without legs, fruit flies with legs where the wings are supposed to be, with wings where the legs are supposed to be, with a bunch of bristles, with no bristles at all. They have radiated the genetic mutations system of a fruit fly in the last 100 years in every conceivable way, chemically, with radiation, you name it. What do you have still? You know they haven't changed anything. And here's what's interesting. They have not added a single digit of new genetic information. You would think that with intelligent people doing the selecting and radiating, that if it were possible to get new genetic information from mutation, we would have gotten that by now. But guess what? Not only do we not have any new genetic information from the fruit fly, here's what we've learned. It doesn't matter what you do to a fruit fly. You can dump any chemical on it you want. You can radiate it any way you want. Guess what you always have at the end of the experiment? A fruit fly. Well, the first aspect of evolution that is the most unscientific and wrong biological statement ever uttered is that you got life from non-living chemicals. And then the second, equally as ridiculous and wrong idea, is that that life changed from one kind of life to another kind of life. Dogs always have puppies. They always have. They always will have puppies. Now, where do you get an idea like that? You see, according to evolution, you had to get one creature that changed into all the different kinds, but we had the law of biogenesis. It's a biological law. It's the most fundamental biological law in the history of anything. Well, when you go back to Genesis chapter 1 and you start reading about life that God creates, on day 3 he creates the flowers, grass, and trees. And do you remember what God commands the organisms that he creates to do? Be fruitful and multiply after your own kind. And on days 5 and 6 he tells the flying animals and the swimming animals to be fruitful and multiply after their own kind. And day 5, the swimming and flying animals. Day 6, the land-living animals and humans. And humans multiply after their own kind. So if you were just to say, okay, according to evolution, you've got to get life from non-living chemicals and it multiplies into something other than its kind. According to creation, you get supernatural created life because you can't get it in the natural world, and it stays the same kind until it goes extinct. What does the fossil record show and what does the biology show? Biology and fossil record show that you get life that appears miraculously, fully formed, and it stays that exact kind of life until it dies out. Well, that's not what you're told in biology textbooks. And it violates, the idea of evolution violates the law of biogenesis at every turn. Now, here is something that's presented to you as evidence of evolution. In fact, this is evolution in action. It's been presented for years and years and years. The English peppered moth. And here's the story that you are spun. Before the Industrial Revolution, when lichens were growing on trees, there was a light-colored moth and a dark-colored moth. And if you were a bird and you flew up to this tree trunk, which one of these two would you eat? Well, obviously, you eat the one that you see. And so if you were a bird, you would eat the dark-colored moth because you could see it. You can't see the light-colored moth because it blends in with the lichens. And so the population of English peppered moth before the Industrial Revolution was 95% light-colored, 5% dark-colored. But you are then told, after the Industrial Revolution, when soot covered the trunks of the trees, well, then the bird that was looking for a meal would see the light-colored moth, and he would eat that, and so the population ratio changed from 95% light to 95% dark, and from 5% dark to 5% light. And they said this is evolution in action. And was used as evidence for natural selection. Okay, let's deal with a couple things here. Number one, before the Industrial Revolution, you had the genetic makeup to make a couple varieties of English peppered moth. What were they? Dark and light. After the Industrial Revolution, you had the genetic makeup to make up a couple of varieties of English peppered moth. What were they? dark and light. What new genetic information was added? Now remember, to get evolution, you've got to add massive billions of bits of genetic information to go from a single cell amoeba to humans. What did you add here? Did you add any teeth, DNA information to get a snout on the English peppered moth, or feathers, or anything new? Okay, no new genetic information is added here. So does this add to the case for evolution? Not in the least. In fact, it'd kind of be like this. Let's say you have a dog, and that dog gives birth to 10 puppies. And 4 of them are light-colored, 6 of them are dark-colored. And in a tragic puppy accident, they're walking across a frozen pond, and 5 of the dark-colored ones fall into the pond. Now you have 4 light-colored and 1 dark-colored puppy. What is that an example of? According to our model here. Evolution in action. Because you change the ratio of the light to dark-colored. But is that really any type of evolution? No, not any type of evolution. Well, you haven't added genetic information in any shape, form, or fashion, and that's what you've got to have. But the second aspect of this, which is more humorous and devious, is you ever seen a mom try to take Easter pictures with a 3-year-old and maybe a 1.5-year-old and a 5-month-old? You know, what's the problem with that? I'll tell you what, at our house, add a duck to the mix or a little rabbit and put that little duck in front of your little 3-year-old and then try to get the 3-year-old to look at the camera. See what happens there. I mean, you take all that. I mean, it'll be 3 hours later and you'll have one picture where the kid is looking at the camera. Just one. You know, isn't it remarkable? Isn't it remarkable how well these moths posed for these pictures? I mean, that's just uncanny. How not only do you have both of them on a tree trunk, but you have both of them on a dark, soot-covered tree trunk, and they are right beside each other in a perfect photographic frame so you can take a picture of it and put it in this textbook. Wow. Except they don't land on tree trunks like that. They land on the underside of leaves, and they move mostly at night, as I understand. And to get these English peppered moths on the tree trunks, they stuck them there, artificially placed them there, glued them or pinned them there. Now, here's what you'd like to think. Okay, these guys just didn't know that. The guys who were doing the teaching on evolution, they just didn't know that these pictures were kind of trumped up. And surely they wouldn't present this stuff if they knew better. Okay, now this is a Canadian textbook writer who used the peppered moth illustration for years to prove evolution. Here's what he said. Well, I mean, you got to look at the audience. How convoluted do you want to make it for a first-time learner? So they said, Bob, you know these are fake. He said, yeah, but if you try to tell them the real truth, it's real complicated. So this works really well for us because it's real simple. Okay, all right. The advantage of this example of natural selection is it's extremely visual. You can see it real well. Now, it's not true, but you can see it real well. Okay, suppose I got a theory that I've got some white cows, and they eat green grass, and they grow purple spots. And you say, cow, that's ridiculous. Of course they don't. I say, yeah, I've got one of those. And so we find some green grass, and I bring 5 of my white cows, and I send them out there. They eat some green grass, and we have a break, and you come back, and they all got purple spots about the size of a baseball. And you say, wow, that's remarkable, Kyle. And one of you who is kind of used to cattle, you go up and you start petting on one of them, and then you have an itch on your forehead, and you start scratching your forehead. Well, and your wife or somebody looks at you and says, man, you got something on your head. Well, you go into the bathroom, you look, sure enough, purple paint all over your head. You think, where did that come from? You look on your hand, you got purple paint all over your hand, and then you go to where you pet that cow, and it's smeared, and you come to me and you say, Kyle, these cows didn't grow purple spots. You painted them on there. I said, yeah, I know. But the advantage of this is that it's extremely visual. Okay, so it doesn't prove anything. No, it doesn't prove anything, but it looks good. Okay, well, we want to get across the idea of adaptation. Later on, they can look at the work more critically. Now, here's the thing. When is later on? When's the all the stuff we told you proved evolution that does not 101 in any university-type setting? You know what I find so remarkable is that many people who went to the highest levels of PhD scientific education never ever learned in their entire studies to look at this type of stuff more critically. Now, what if you put a sticker in the front of a book that says, When we tell you about an English pepper moth, we want you to critically consider what's being said. We want you to think through it. Well, if anybody was thinking through the English peppered moth for the last 50 years of study, that would have been removed from the text 39 and a half years ago. But if you start taking out all the stuff we know doesn't prove evolution, you've got a very thin volume that quickly you begin to see doesn't have any real evidence. And so this has been used in textbook for years and not evidence at all. Well, here you go, Ernst Haeckel. He had this idea that you should be able to prove in some type of repeatable form evolution. He read On the Origin of Species by Natural Selection, and he said, we've got to be able to prove that. And so he comes up with his idea called the Law of Embryology. And here's what he said. He says, every creature goes through its evolutionary history in its embryology stage. And he came up with the way he said, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, you're sitting in one of his university class, and he says the law of embryology says ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. You just feel smarter hearing it, don't you? What's ontogeny? The process of an embryo growing. What's phylogeny? It's supposed evolutionary history. So supposedly, you can zoom in on a human embryo, and we'll catch it in a fish stage. And then you'll catch it in a monkey stage. And then you'll catch it in a, you know, going from lizard stage, lower mammal stage. And so they say, what evidence do you have for that, Haeckel? He says, oh, we got all kinds of evidence for that. In fact, look at these pictures. He said, look right here. All of these embryos start out with gill slits. And then as they change the similarities, and the dog, the turtle, the pig, the human, they all go through the same stages all the way up to human. Well, his colleagues that were around in the late 1880s said, hold on, Haeckel, wait just a second. That doesn't look like embryos we've ever seen. I mean, we've looked at some embryos, and they look more like that. Where do you get an idea that they all have gill slits? Do you know that for about 100 or more years, this idea of humans having gill slits was used as evidence for evolution, when from the time it was presented, we knew it was false? Now, you don't have to take my word for that. This is Stephen Jay Gould writing in 2000. He was one of the most well-known atheists and evolutionists of his day. He said in his article titled Atrocious, named there in German, Haeckel's distortions did not help Darwin. And here's what he said. Haeckel remains the most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument that science disproved long ago. Okay, so this has been disproven from basically the time it was presented. Now, notice what he says. He says, we should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings entered the textbooks in the 1800s, the late 1800s. But we should, I think, have the right to be astonished and ashamed at a century of mindless recycling that has led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not the majority, of textbooks. He said, yeah, it's one thing to get in. It's another thing to stay there for 120 years. Well, hold on, why is that surprising? What are you telling the kids not to do? When you put a sticker at the front that says, look at this stuff critically with an open mind and study it carefully, and you rip that out and tell the kids, no, you cannot do that. You want them to mindlessly accept this stuff. Well, there's a reason that something like this that's used to teach evolution stays in the textbooks for over 120 years. It's because there is a system that says, don't think about it, just believe it. We can't really prove it, but this is what we'll give you, and as long as you don't think too deeply on it, then it'll be fine. But if you were to look at this with an open mind and study it carefully and critically consider it, well, you would start with, hold on just a second. Evolution is based on the idea that life popped into existence from non-life, and there's no scientific evidence for that. Evolution is based on the idea that one kind of life changed from one kind to another, and there's absolutely no evidence for that. Evolution is based on all of these ideas that you're told are proven, and when you say, well, give me some evidence that proves it, well, here's some, but don't think about it too much. Because if you do, we'll have to give you some more that then you won't be able to think about too much. Why? I mean, the simple fact is evolution didn't happen. Creation by the hand of a supernatural, intelligent creator is the only thing that squares with all the evidence that you've got. And the irony is, we're told, well, it's these poor religious faith thumpers that are such blind followers to what they're given every Sunday. But evolution is the one that you're not supposed to look at with an open mind, study it carefully, or critically consider it, and ends up being a century or more of mindless recycling because you're not supposed to think about this stuff. Because if you do, we'll be in trouble. Well, keep going. You guys recognize this? Horse evolution, yes, put in most all textbooks. And here's what we're told, this little hierarchotherium. Well, it evolved into Mesohippus and the Myohippus and the Merychippus and Pliohippus and eventually to modern Equus. And you can see how the toes fused to form this one single hoofed creature. And this is evolution in action. And it was used in textbooks for decades, decades. Here's what's interesting to me. George Gaylord Simpson says, the uniform continuous transformation of Hylocotherium into Equus, so dear to the hearts of modern generations of textbook writers, it never happened in nature. Well, hold on a second. Where did you get this continuous transformation? You put it in textbooks. You drew a picture of it. Where did you get it? Well, he said, you didn't get it out in nature. Because in nature, that's not what happened. Well, where did you get it? So dear to the hearts of generations of mindless textbook writers, it never happened in nature. Where did it happen? There's only one place that ever happened. In the minds of the textbook writers. If you were then to go and say, okay, can you show me where this happened in nature? They said, nah, we can't show you because it doesn't really play out like that because two or three of these creatures are alive at the same time, so this one couldn't have turned into this one, but it just looks so nice on a page. So you mean to tell me there's no connection at all between Hylocotherium and Equus in any type of biological or even fossil evidence, but you just drew it like that so people would think there was? Yeah. And you've known that's not true for decades? Yeah. Well, how's it gotten through? Well, because you just don't think about it critically or with an open mind or carefully considered, and that's the only way it goes through. Well, now then, this is the latest. That we're told this idea of homology. That if stuff looks the same, then it had to evolve or had to be related to whatever it looks like. And you know, they'll parade a picture of a father and a son right next to him, and that son looks very close to the father, and they'll say, this homology, this similarity proves that this son is related to this father. And then they will go to things like the human hand, the cat wrist, the whale wrist, and the bat wrist. And they'll say, look, those are all made from the same sets of bones. They're very much alike. They're homologous. And so that proves that they evolved from one another. Okay, real simple question. It's easy to understand. Yeah, sometimes, you know, you have a kid that looks very much like a dad and they're closely related. That means that sometimes you have a child that looks very much like somebody that they're not related to anywhere close at all. And yet they're almost the spitting image of them, but you couldn't trace their closeness to that person for hundreds of generations. And here's what we're saying. Is it the fact that sometimes descendancy means things look close? Yeah, that does, but sometimes, and I would suggest in this case, the idea of a common designer makes much more sense than the idea of a common ancestor. And so you ask the simple question, well, why do so many different creatures have noses and lungs? Well, because they're going to be smelling and they're going to be breathing the same atmospheric air. Well, why do so many creatures have ears that look similar, that behave or act similarly? Well, because they're going to be picking up the same vibrations of sounds that are coming from the laws of nature. So, you go out in the parking lot and you see a car that has four wheels and those four wheels have rubber tires on them, and there's another car right next to that one and it's got four wheels and they have rubber tires. Why? Because those cars are related. Not because those cars are related at all, but because they're intelligent people that know those cars can be driving on the same roads. And they're going to be going over the same terrain, and they're going to need to be going to the same places. They use gasoline. Now, some of them use diesel, and some of them now are electric, but you have similarities between gasoline vehicles and four wheels on each of the... Why is that? Is it because those cars evolve from one another? No, it's because there's an intelligent design behind that. And so would it make perfect sense that if God is going to create a world where humans are going to need to learn things about themselves from the world, that he would create certain animals to be genetically close to humans so that they could look at those animals and see what would happen if this was done to a human? Or look at the world around them and see, okay, these creatures breathe air just like I do. These creatures drink water just like I do. A common designer is as good or better of an answer as a common ancestor. And so when you look and see similarities, it has nothing to do with common ancestry, but common design. And so if you were just to go through the ideas that supposedly prove evolution, okay, why do all of these tables in one shape, form, or fashion have four legs? Well, they descended from one another. Or four legs happens to be a good design. And it's used periodically. Now, are some legs three-legged tables? Are some tables three-legged? Yes, yeah, sometimes. But a very good design is four legs and has nothing to do with descendancy, does it? And so as you're looking at this idea, when you start going through the textbooks and you start applying a critical mind and look at it with an open mind, you critically consider it, you carefully look at what's going on. Well, let me tell you what happens. We have a book titled Truth Be Told where we went through the textbooks and did just that and have refuted the things like this and other aspects of evolution that's taught in those. But we also have a science writer that is right now working as a lead for NASA in some of the rocket science there in Huntsville, Alabama. His name is Mike Houts. He's got a PhD from MIT. And when you sit and talk to Mike Houts, he grew up in a home that was atheistic. They just didn't believe in God, and he followed a very strenuous line of education. He's a brilliant individual. But along the way, he said, it dawned on him that he had been accepting this information for evolution for so many years, and he just hadn't ever applied himself to see if it was true. And so he decided he was going to. And so he started looking at these things that he had always been taught proved evolution, English peppered moss and the homology argument and the various other aspects of a creature gaining genetic information, etc. And he started asking the simple question, is this true? And as he was asking that question, he realized all this stuff that is supposedly proving evolution, it does not prove that. And so he studied himself out of evolution and atheism, studied himself into belief in God, and then went even further and studied himself into New Testament Christianity, was baptized into Christ, and now, as a Christian scientist, will present information and does on a regular basis across the world as he works at NASA and is a lead on jet propulsion and rocket propulsion, will then travel to anywhere that will allow him to speak and talk about how real science validates creation and how we have been lied to when it comes to lots of this evolutionary evidence. And so, what I would just contend is that if we will just look at all of the information with an open mind, study it carefully, and critically consider it, at the end of the day, the conclusion to which we will arrive is that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. All right, that is our second lesson for the morning. If you have any questions, be glad to field those. Any questions along these lines? Yes?
When someone, an ordinary person who believes in creation, is speaking to another ordinary person who believes in evolution, what would you say is a good, solid first point for the creationist to bring up in presenting that evolution isn't true to that person?
Now, in my opinion, the most solid point, I think, is the fact that organisms have remarkable functional design, that there's no example in any scientific experiment or anything ever done where you can get functional design by accident. And so the design argument to me, and it's the one that convinced Anthony Flew that we talked about last night. He just said, the DNA? I mean, how do you get written, coded information that gives you design when it is put into practice? From the DNA to the... How do you get that from an accidental process? Just you know, what I often say is just show me one example where coded information comes about accidentally. And I can show you scores of examples where coded information is a product of an intelligent person, intelligent being. And so I think the design argument is the very strongest. And just, you know, what we're told is that genetic information builds up. Well, what's happening is the exact opposite of that. Mutations are bringing the total amount of genetic information down. It's really like you have genetic entropy. It's like a room that's getting messier. And so what we're told is you started with a tiny, tiny piece of genetic information that came about by accident and got better. And what I just then say is, number one, show me where any coded information ever comes by accident. And then, not only where it comes by accident, but then builds up. And there's just, there's not any. And so, I mean, most of the time my answer to that is, well, we just can't see it. It's so slow. It's so, just give me one example of it. And there's just not one. So that's what I think is, to me, is the strongest point, is just the design argument, really. That's a good question. That's right. And what we're told in genetics is, but somehow that's opposite. But then when you look, there's a book out right now by a scientist, it's called Genetic Entropy. And he says, okay, we've always known that physically. Now let's apply that to genetics and see what happens. And when you do, it's an overall loss of information. Genetics is getting messier.
Well, I guess going off of that is the idea of mutation has been tried to be put forward as an evidence for evolution, like you talked about with just with the fruit fly. But mutation never brings more design. It just breaks down the design and see my understanding of it.
That's right. And see what you've got to have. It does not add. Now it can duplicate information. It can twist information, move it around, etc. Like, okay, so you've got a strand of DNA that codes for a wing. Well, if you mutate it right, you can get that strand to go code it to grow on its head. But you can't add information to get that wing to turn into something else. And so that's the problem. Mutations only mess with information that's there already, and they even make that worse. And for evolution to be true, you would have to have new genetic information written into the code. And that's where it doesn't get written. There's nothing like that.
The way I think about illustrating that is, if you had a paragraph of information out of a book, you could shake that information, jumble it up, jumble the words any way you wanted to. And that's kind of what's going on here with those fruit flies and other illustrations, other experiments. But what you're never doing is adding new words. So the same words you started with in the paragraph, even if you want to jumble them up, mix them up, it's always the same words. They're just in different orders, creating mutations, breaking down of the complexity of the design, but it's never, you're never adding new. It takes intelligence to add those things.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good illustration, yeah.
It seems like scientists have been trying to prove for such a long time, because I even remember studying that they thought that fruit flies came from meat a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're saying, oh, substance based or another living thing based from meat, not living.
Right.
Then what was happening, what they did was they put saran wrap over the jars of meat, and they found out that what was actually happening was the fruit flies were coming in,
mm-hmm.
and they were attracted to the meat and would eat that.
Right.
So then they couldn't even prove that.
Right.
So it seems like scientists will say, oh, well, spontaneous generation is fiction or cannot happen, but it happened over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, and the irony is, that's what they'll show, like Francisco reading, doing all those experiments, and they'll say, so he proved spontaneous generation didn't happen. So they'll say that in one sentence. And then the next paragraph they'll say, but it must have happened in the past, because that's how life arose. Well, you just proved it didn't, so then why would you say spontaneous, see, and so basically violation of law by Genesis, that you have to have in order for evolution to be true, but scientifically, every experiment ever done shows that spontaneous generation doesn't work. So yeah, very good point. Excellent. Yes, sir.
Can you use the laws of thermodynamics to help us talk to people who are interested in the sciences that way to explain to them, you know, the laws of conservation where you can't get something from nothing? These scientists have written those laws, but they don't want us to adhere to their own laws. So how do you talk to them?
Well, you're exactly right. And we'll just deal with the first law of thermodynamics, which is basically conservation of matter and energy, which says in nature, matter or energy is neither created nor destroyed, but just changes forms. Okay, so you lay that down and ask if you believe that. And they say, yeah, you know, we believe it. And then you say, okay, so where did the first stuff come from? That singularity, they call it a singularity. But then, what we said last night, and what they are forced to say is, but it didn't act like matter and energy does now. So it needed to act different than matter and energy. Okay? So what? Well, basically they say that first thing had to act outside of the laws of matter. Okay? That's what we've been saying for years. A supernatural entity that doesn't act like matter. Well, what they want to say is, no, that's not what we're saying. We're saying it's all matter, this just doesn't act like matter. See the problem there? So what they get to is, yes, something had to not act like matter, but we're going to say it was matter and just say at some point it didn't act like it. Well, you can say that, but then you can't call it matter. And so that what I think the first law of thermodynamics is great because you say, okay, we've got the material universe. So it's got all the matter and energy that can possibly exist according to the first law of thermodynamics. Where did that come from? If in nature you can't add or subtract it, what added it? Well, it had to be a supernatural entity to add it in order for the first law of thermodynamics to work. So, but like I said, the answer is, well, it just didn't act like it. It was matter, but it didn't act like matter. So, super matter.
And I guess, it seems like the second law of thermodynamics, it seems like, to me, it's so obvious, but it seems like scientists' answer is, you know, something about quantum mechanics or something, and, you know, my eyes just sort of glaze over when I hear that stuff.
Yes, and, quantum mechanics doesn't even do it for them. We've done some writing on that. But, you know, basically the idea of the second law of thermodynamics, where energy is moving toward a less useful, less usable state. When you take a log and you've got the energy there and you burn it and it goes into heat and ash and things and it's less usable than it was. Here's their contention. That in isolated places, you can decrease entropy if you use energy from other places. Now, let me explain. That means you personally can make this auditorium neater by, okay, it's going, dust is falling, stuff, but you can come in and add the right kind of energy and fix it. Okay, you can put the sound booths back on the pews, etc., and when you get done with it, it's cleaner. Okay, but here's the issue. The only time that any isolated area decreases in entropy is if an intelligent entity comes in and applies the right energy. And even still, the overall energy is still moving toward less usability, if that makes any sense. And so you can go into a factory and you as an intelligent being can put energy in it to make it less messed up at the cost of energy outside of the factory. But that only works if you've got an intelligent being actually applying the right energy in the right places. So what they're wanting to do is say, okay, yes, in certain places like in this primordial soup or whatever, the right kind of energy at the right kind of time was used to decrease entropy in the soup, but overall increase it outside. Well, so basically what you're saying is there was an intelligent being that somehow applied the right energy at this point and did something that fixed things. And so that's their challenge. That's what they would say. Well, in certain isolated places, entropy can decrease. Well, yeah, we'll show me an example of it. Okay, when you come in and clean up an auditorium, okay, well, who came in and cleaned it? A person. An intelligent being applying the energy in the right places. But still overall, you have a decrease of energy when you add it all up. And so it still doesn't really work for them, but that's what they argue now. Well, see, they're saying you're adding energy from a star and you're adding it to planet Earth. And so planet Earth's energy entropy is decreasing. But the overall, if you count the star, et cetera, is all increasing. So they're not saying it's coming from an entity outside of...
But still, even that star has a finite amount.
Well, see, that's their second problem. So really all you're doing is moving the problem. You're just backing it up to the star now. Right. I can, and it's actually very simple, and here's what I mean. There's the idea that there are an infinite number of universes, multiverses, and now Stephen Hawking put this idea in his latest book, The Green Design, although he recently passed away, and here's why he did it. He said, if you take our universe as the only one, probabilistically that's impossible because it's perfect. All the stuff looks exactly right. It's all balanced on sharper than a razor's edge. If ours is the only one, then basically there's got to be a God. So how do you get ours being perfect and there still not be a God? Well, if you postulate that there are an infinite number of universes and ours is just one out of infinite number and we happen to be in the perfect one, but there's a lot of other ones out there, then okay, that would work. Well, okay, here's the problem. When you say that would work, do you have evidence for another universe? No. Is there any physical, even quantum physics that would suggest that there are infinite number? No. Well, why would you suggest an infinite number universe? Well, because if this only one got them, there's got to be a creator. So we've got to think up some reason to say this one's perfect, but there's not a creator. And so we've got a long article on the idea of a multiverse. And basically the physicists themselves say, okay, look, if we're going to start just making up stuff that will answer things, but you don't have to have evidence for it, then you can use the multiverse. But if we're going to keep science as an evidence-based system, the multiverse doesn't work. And so even a lot of the quantum physicists and the people involved in it say, once you go multiverse, you've basically just stepped out of science and said, we'll just say whatever. And we can just make everything be possible, and we don't have to have it. Evidence for anything. Because, here, you know, the problem is, okay, so we got one universe, and it looks exactly right for people to live on it. And that came from an explosion. We know that's not possible. So we've got to do something about that. And Hawking has a very, very interesting statement where he says, and I know that's problematic, So what can you do about that? Okay, there's a billion universes, and ours is just one of them. Okay, well, give me any legitimate scientific evidence for one more universe. Well, I don't have any, but without another billion, none of it makes sense. So you're going to postulate extra billion universes and just increase your problem. So I know that's all kind of heady stuff, but I mean, that is the mental gymnastics that people get around, that people throw out to try to get around in the being God created the heavens and the earth. They just don't want a creator to be there. And here's why. Because if there is a creator, well, then that creator tells you what you can and can't do. And what will happen to you when you die. And what moral rules and laws you need to follow. And they don't want that. And so... Absolutely. Yeah. Well, see, your body on a regular basis decreases entropy, basically. It takes stuff in and works it. Well, how does a cell somehow may continue to live and not just immediately fluff into nothing? Well, because it's so well designed that it can take energy in and at a... So you're right, it's got to be intelligence behind the design of whatever it is to keep it from going to nothing. Yeah, exactly right. Okay, well, we will take a little break. What time you got down? 11:24. All right, we'll take a break till 11:30.